Welcome to the June 17th, 2024 meeting in Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everybody for participating and remind everybody to silence all electronic devices. Today's meeting is a study and business session with both sessions starting this morning at 9 a.m. And probably concluding both sessions before noon. We will have an executive session this afternoon at 1 p.m. 90 minutes and workshop for 90 minutes after that. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. Members of the public are encouraged to provide comments and ask specific questions related to the agenda. And to matters not on the agenda, time will be provided at the end of the business session of our meeting. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand signaling that you wish to speak. Come up to the microphone, state your name and address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today, we have all five commissioners present: Hudson General Manager, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Newman, clerk of the board. Please join Micah Linderman leading the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Amendment.
Hang on, Micah, just 1 second. I'll get you started and share. Yep, 2 seconds. There you go.
Right, this morning I'm going to talk about safety and how we can learn from others. So the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and Highway Loss Data Institute are two outstanding resources that are available for anybody. They're independent, they're scientific, and they're highly educational. Most people's eyes are going to glaze over the mention of insurance and data, but this will grab your attention. This is what the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety does. They're the people who methodically destroy millions of dollars of vehicles. What you see up here is actually our vehicle. This is what my wife and I drive. And you can go on and find your vehicle, and you can watch in slow motion various angles. You can see how the crash test bays collide with airbags, with windows, with structures. It is extremely humbling to watch. And so if you yourself are thinking about a vehicle for yourself, others, this is a great resource to check. But you don't have to be an engineer. They summarize this data for you. They have color code, good, moderate, poor. And they do a variety of different types of crash tests that actually simulate real world collisions. The kind of things that people might envision, like this head-on collision, that really doesn't happen. So they simulate real world collisions and summarize that for you. They can also test various rules of thumbs or assumptions that people have. What you see here is intentionally selected small cars. People inherently think big car is good, big car protects it. Rules of physics still apply, but mass inertia, they still matter. But just because you're in a big car does not mean you're well protected. If you're in a small car, doesn't mean you're going to be dead in a crash. So there's a variety of different classes you can look up, and you can look up how does my car score, how does potential purchase score. The top safety pick plus, that's the best you can pick. It scores well across a variety of these different tests. Top safety pick is the next level down, and then just don't cut it, you don't cut it. So this really simplifies the buying experience. You don't have to be an engineer, you don't have to go around crash test vehicles. So they all make these reports. So that's the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. The partner organization is called the Highway Loss Data Institute. And unfortunately, there are millions of accidents every single year, millions and millions. But the Highway Loss Data Institute collects all that information, normalizes it, simplifies it, so you can actually look at a variety of different coverages, for instance, bodily injury, collision, property damage, and see how a variety of these vehicles stack up against each other. So you can make a really smart decision with respect to how would this car affect me, passengers, others on the road. So all that to say is there are resources that are out there. One actually destroys these vehicles. They do it physically, mechanically. This other, the sister organization, takes that data, normalize, but you don't have to be a statistician and make it simple for it. You can compare how that vehicle would compare against others. Others you might be considering, or again, others, loved ones that might be made in your state of purpose. So, and my key takeaway is when it comes to vehicle purchase, when it comes just about anything, there is lots of data that's out there. There's so much noise, so much, so much burden. And just because it's out there, it doesn't mean it's accurate, doesn't mean it's factually correct. There's information that's out there. That's sure that's a step up. What's actually going to help you make a smart, informed decision for you, yourself, your life? So take that knowledge. It is out there. Others have done it for you. Thank you.
So the IIHS and the HLDI, if you look those up, we will get to moving.
Absolutely. IIHS, great. IIHS for it. It'll send you there. And there's probably there's sections of back to here. But you reviewed part of this as well. I got a couple of team directors. They have a module for the code. Team directors, team directors. Say it could be a team directors to think that. So there are other modules that they've done too. My familiarity with Phil Lee is from producer service and insurance industry. They have modules. I worked on a module about motorcycles. The motorcycles are one distracted driving is alcohol, graduated driving. They have a variety of modules that are out there. Again, this is independent education. It's very scientific. So the resource for anyone. Consumers, businesses, policy.
You've got a grand. Good time to pick.
Yep, it is. And information's out there and can't argue for a bias. It is. I actually participated in some of this, the data scrubbing that goes into the conversation. Regrets.
Well, obviously, I find this fascinating.
I just wouldn't play with the
Well, and what this does is that it opens a door for a public service announcement by Commissioner Allen. So we have friends who were in Canada in a very serious accident and became aware that Canada is a no-fault country. And so the result is they have, he's been flown to Harborview, so he has hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own expenses that unfortunately the person who hit them died in the accident. So his future is going to be long in recovery and unknown from a financial perspective. So the PSA is if you are going abroad, be in a safe vehicle and buy travel insurance when you go to Canada. FYI, I don't know if you guys knew that. We go to Canada often, and this was the first I was aware of it. So thank you for opening that door for me.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Brings us bad memories of the car accident. Well, we were one of those people, Michael's leaving, but we were one of the, and you said few people, there's few studies on head-ons at full speed. We were one of those people. And needless to say, when we were talking about the same car, because it saved our lives. So it was a small 60 miles an hour head-on, and we made it through it. So anyway, that was sobering. Thank you, Micah. All right, commissioners, we have an agenda in front of us. Management is not recommending moving anything, any items to the consent agenda. And additionally, for the public's information, items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any requests or additions to the agenda? Agenda stands. Okay. Kurt, let's move on to item number 3, sleep community.
Okay, I'd like to invite Toby Tarkwell up to the desk there. It's an honor to recognize Toby as the May Cycle of Personal Ownership Award winner, and he was nominated for his work on a number of contracts, and one of them happens to be one of the resolutions you're going to hear about later, which is the enterprise contract. And Toby actually took on a challenge. I don't know if somebody talked him into this or not, but the process, these unit price contracts are used all over the PUD. Multiple departments use these contracts. And one of the challenges is trying to understand and recognize how much room is in each contract for the work to be done, how much has been authorized, how much has been spent. And Toby came up with a way to create a dashboard or visibility for people using these contracts to see where they're at and the amount authorized and yet to be spent. And so something that people didn't think could be done, Toby figured out a way to do it. So just appreciate his can-do attitude and always looking for continuous improvement opportunities and his ownership and trying to make things better, not just for the work he's doing, but for everybody else in the PUD that's doing work. So congratulations, Toby. You had some stiff competition for this award, but ultimately you were recognized as the winner. So appreciate your work.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate being here. Appreciate the opportunity to work with people that give me an opportunity to make an impact and a change like this. The project delivery unit, the fiber group, the distribution group, and all the team members that helped bring this about and get into effect. So I'm here on behalf of a lot of people, and we're all thankful.
Good. Hey, well, Toby, thank you very much, and congratulations, and keep doing good work.
Thank you.
I'll be back in a little while to talk about one of those unit price contracts.
Electrical load growth update.
I'd like to invite Lyle Mora. Morning, Lyle.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lyle Mora, Supervisor for Customer Service in June. This morning, we're going to talk about quarterly load update. So today, we'll review the number of meters set for year-to-date for 2024, applications and inquiries, updated load forecast, substation build-out, and there's no action required for the request today. And our meters that we've set so far is roughly about 260 so far this year. We still project about 700 new residential, commercial, and industrial type meters set for this year. A little bit of an uptick from last year, where we're trying to catch up on some of the supply chain challenges that our customers are experiencing. Last quarter, we talked a little bit about what the trend looks like for 20 years. So we went back and looked at our annual report. This represents residential, commercial, and industrial type meters as a whole across our district. So you can see a trend in there. We can see some slowdowns where we saw around 2010, 2011, the economy slowed down a little bit. We see the rise before that time period, and we see the rise after that, where we experience growth around here. So this represents, again, residential, commercial, and industrial meters. So it doesn't represent every single meter that we have out there, but related to our annual reports, this is how we come up with a data set that we can look back on.
Question.
Commissioner, are you muted?
Thank you.
Thank you.
A question. This looks like a slow and steady trend line. At the same time, at some moment in here, we really refocused heavily on energy conservation activities. So this increase is the conservation is on top of this. In terms of what we would anticipate as our usage, I don't know if I'm asking the question the right way. If we hadn't done the conservation, how would this chart look?
I think the chart would be similar. Conservation is really going to impact our energy usage overall. So, I mean, we may see a slight change, and people are like, well, they don't conserve very well. They don't have a lot of incentives in Shawnee County to go there. So maybe they don't become a new customer. as far as a meter set. But this data really is our number of customers that we have that we're looking at. So it's not the total energy usage, but conservation with CAP that change. If that had total energy usage.
So the chart I'm thinking about would be the net.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hope I can report. I can ask you a question. Thank you, Randy. What I find really fascinating, in 2008, we went into an economic downturn nationwide, well, globally for that matter. And yet we continue to see meter grow. And that's I just find that fascinating that even during 8, 9, 10, when the economy, global economy was kind of on its heels, we continue to see growth.
We did see it. I don't know the percentage of growth at that time, but we did see some of this.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah,
that's darn impressive for the resiliency of our community.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you.
I might add, Commissioner Arsenault, that is one of the things. There was some growth. You can see it was smaller than the average year, but that is one of the things we talked about in the 2008, 9, 10 timeframe that this area didn't seem to experience the recessionary impacts that the rest of the country was experiencing. And there was a little bit of a delay when it hit here, but it was smaller than what the rest of the region and country would. I think it does speak to resiliency in our community and that there are some things here, some industries here that tend to buffer some of those impacts, maybe more so than other areas.
Thank you. FYI, Commissioner Bergner is the one that highlighted this for me, and I hadn't really paid attention to it. Recessionary times are generally strong times for the fruit industry. And that may be part of what you're seeing right here is the fruit industry held really solid through that whole thing. It was a good time for the fruit industry.
Notable applications and inquiries. We still are working with the transit and they're building their new facility, which will have a vehicle charging component to it. Still working with the tribes on the hotel, casino, convenience store, and again, some electrical charging facilities up in the Manson area. The Diamond Foundry, we are working with them on an expansion program. So we anticipate seeing about 2 megawatts of load coming on in the near future with them. And then there's a potential of about 7 more megawatts, really depending on how fast they expand, what that looks like, what their economy is, what their business plans are. Majestic Apartments is a facility in the Manchin, still we're working on them, figuring how to get some service to them, some major infrastructure changes there, but that project continues to go forward. As well as we're seeing other inquiries around maybe a training facility for firearms with a firing range. We're looking at a pressure plant. So we're seeing some inquiries come in that are not our standard residential single phase extension going out in certain individual homes. That's a little bit reflected in our numbers. So we're seeing numbers going down a little bit, but we're seeing more of that infrastructure, what it takes to maintain this value. So people here. In your electrical load forecast, very similar to what we presented last quarter, but we're actively working on what that update looks like. We anticipate having that all wrapped up, and it will be considered an updated forecast in at the next presentation quarter. Substation planning, we still have our focus on the variant sub. Work continues on that. Looking at the Wenatchee area, the Wenatchee substation to be in the Western Hills, foothills area, and our work going on in Manson up there with the North Shore sub and some site review around the Dry Lake. That was a slick area. That ties right into substation activity. North Shore sub is not quite energized yet. We're anticipating towards the end of the month, but one of those dates that keeps getting pushed up just a little bit related to work that needs to get done, scheduling, getting that work done, making sure we got it all blessed up and meets our criteria. Leavenworth sub design work still continues on that. Again, the Wenatchee area, we're evaluating what options look like for downtown Wenatchee, the western part of Wenatchee area as well. And then again, the Manson area around those estates, that site acquisition, there's a property up there. And then we have a variety of rebuild programs, maintenance programs through our service territory. So in summary, a little bit slower residential type growth for our residential line extension type people. Caveat that a little bit that we are seeing some apartment type work going in, so that will influence those numbers a little bit on the residential side. New developments, we still get lots of inquiries about that. Chelan is a busy area for new developments. There's lots of property up there that people are exploring what that looks like. Antioch is seeing activity. We have activity going on as well. New electrical vehicle stations, again, with the tribes up in Manson, we're seeing that. Over here with Link, and we have several inquiries going in the Wenatchee area too, as far as some grant that happened last fall, but people trying to take advantage of some of those programs and get some new facilities in here. There's no material shift away from our substation build plan. We're still on track with what it looks like for right now. We anticipate any changes. And again, we're sitting pretty well as far as staying ahead of load growth. It's a little bit of a challenge once in a while, but we're making those decisions and we're evaluating our priorities. We're in good shape. That opening up for any other questions.
I've got one for deadline for you.
I believe that is. I'm not an expert on that.
So. Okay.
But I thought it was a cool picture. Thank you.
Is that a don't mix electricity and water together? It's a picture.
Had a really thick piece of glass.
Commissioner, are you muted?
No, I'm not.
Okay, maybe just a little closer.
All right. No questions. Let's move on to agenda item number 5, the talk about insurance.
Yep, Ron Gibbs is here to give us an update on the insurance process. Busy for Ron in the last few weeks. Insurance.
Thank you, Mr. Ron Gibbs, Manager of Insurance Risk Management. Here today to talk about the program renewal on July 1st. Our annual update. We are in this in the midst of negotiations, but we will be asking for approval of a motion that authorizes renewal of the program for $7.8 million. I'll say the part of this presentation will feel a little bit like an extension of the discussion that we had on June 3rd about some of the challenges that we're facing with wildfire risk. But on this slide, I'll talk about some of the high level factors that are affecting overall program on the property side. We are looking at increases that are caused by inflation. We have a 7.5% increase in property value in 2023-2024. About 3% of our property values currently are new facilities. So that's a piece of that. Again, wildfire risk remains a challenge for the entire utility industry, ourselves included. I'll share a little bit more, but I can say that the SOM expansion was very important to insurance underwriters, along with the other wildfire risk mitigation work that we're doing. In fact, I see very few questions about any other exposures for liability underwriters, so that's definitely driving the discussion. Large wildfire losses. And coverage options. insurance companies are reducing coverage, as I mentioned back on June 3rd, or no longer providing coverage. I mentioned the recent litigation coming out of Labor Day fires in Oregon resulted in awards that were much higher than expected historically. And we want to share that these types of awards become the norm. Doing the math, it's like we may not be able to buy enough insurance to cover our exposure, so just want to make sure that we're aware of that. But in the meantime, we are monitoring the legal landscape. We're going to be looking at other litigations going on across the country between utilities. Those have been damaged by wildfire, and also monitoring the appeals court down in the Labor Day fires to see what happens there. So we can determine if we are really seeing a certain trend up. So as you, I'm sure recall, each year I go meet with insurance underwriters to highlight the quality of the district's operations and reduce our management of the utility overall. And the goal is to demonstrate that we are properly managing our risk so that insurance companies provide coverage at the lowest rates possible. But ideally, in a perfect world, insurance companies compete for our business, and we certainly have seen that in the past. And when that happens, we can receive lower premiums. In better terms, when conditions are more challenging, however, we really have to adjust our expectations and just try to maintain the status quo as much as possible. This year, I delivered presentations to 31 different insurance underwriters, different types. So, really are trying to make sure that we've looked at all possible options for insurance worldwide for coverage. So on the liability side, obviously the discussion centered around wildfire. These are hour-long discussions, and so it's a good opportunity to go into great detail about our wildfire mitigation practices. I've been involved on the planning team for wildfire mitigation, so that really helps respond to the questions that come up. But we, in addition to the FSOM expansion, we talked about things like our vegetation management program, reclosing, conversion of wood poles to steel poles, just too many things to list, but we have done a lot of work on wildfire mitigation the last number of years, and we're seeing that make an impact. I'll also share that we share more generally about the wildfire planning process, so they can see that leadership is involved in that process, and that we have executive sponsorship throughout that whole wildfire planning process. A priority for the district, and it's also important for them to see. And of course, I also emphasize that for the last 40 plus years that we have worked, I haven't been able to identify a single insured loss over that other. So that definitely gets the insurance company. On the property side of things, the risk of mechanical failures at our power facilities, their primary concern, of course, they're also interested in dam safety, but we do cover mechanical breakdown losses with our insurance program. So all of the work that we're doing to modernize our equipment is very much appreciated. They also like to hear about the data analytic capabilities that we're developing. And I share how we're working towards trying to achieve predictive maintenance by looking at the data coming out of our plants and analyzing that, setting our maintenance schedules to the actual data versus just the loop. Schedule. We're not there yet, but we've made a lot of progress. Impressed with the Hydro Research Institute. And then I also provided an update on how we're beginning to use that Hydro Research Institute data part of our own research for our own equipment. So the decisions that we'll make there as well. They also, of course, are very interested in our asset management program. You know, from an insurance perspective, obviously, they would love to see how we are not running our equipment until it fails, but trying to project with the optimum time to replace that equipment. In July, we have probably will have 4 to 5 insurance underwriters, which are still setting. We have 4 commitments who will come out to our plant and do a tour. We're going to have them also sit down with the asset management group for about an hour and a half and really go through all of the tools that they've created. which I think are very impressive. I've tried to share what I can in the underwriter meetings, but I think seeing the subject matter experts speak to it firsthand, that will go a long ways. So these are some of the things we're trying to do to keep our rates as low as possible. As we talked about in June 3rd, you know, we've had the captive insurance presentation. We've been working with the state to attempt to determine how we might be able to use captive insurance and be in compliance with the RCWs. The idea was that, you know, we have been looking at a potential gap in coverage, and then we'll be able to completely fill our $150 million in insurance limits. So we're looking at that as a tool. And the RTWs are pretty technical and a challenge to interpret. And so that's why we're working with the state to make certain. Initially, they told us that they were researching the EISL captive option, but that we could have a standalone captive. They since came back and said, actually, that upon further review, another option is a possibility for us this year. So for this year, if we are not able to $150 million, you handle that through our own reserves and other funding. If we were to have a loss, that is. Now, that said, we have not given up on this. The investor owned utilities are allowed to have captains. So we are a team of us that's working to think of other options on how in future years we can meet those RCW requirements, potentially also the lobbying efforts, I guess, and changes in the statutes. Most wouldn't think it would make sense to allow industrial utilities to have access to these tools, which, by the way, the insurance commissioner said it's management tools. Not giving up on this, so hopefully next time we come for a renewal discussion next year. So we shall see. Tax insurance availability definitely reflect. The good news is the renewal process so far is beating the expectations that we had going into the process. It's looking more and more likely that we will be able to achieve our $450 million in wildfire limits. We've had some developments that we were not expecting, quite frankly, and I think the ESSOM expansion is playing a big part of that. And in addition to the other wildfire mitigation work that we had, one clarification we had for this, that the pricing in this market is astounding. We had a quote for $15 million in coverage at a price of $1.5 million. So $100,000 per million in coverage. This is with an underwriter that I've met personally with. The broker happened to be in the same location, was able to sit down with that underwriter, go through the wildfire mitigation, emphasize the ESSOM expansion. And that underwriter dropped his quote from $1.5 million down to $300,000. Based on that discussion, although he would not provide the official quote until he received confirmation from us that we had actually expanded the ESSOM program. So that was worth it. And I think it seems like positive. But you know, the current market conditions, as I said, are unusual, historic in its sense, and the wide range of possibilities. So far, you'll see on the grid that we have $90 million quoted. We've achieved now $108 million. There's some pieces here and there, whatever we can to fill up this limit. But there is still the potential that we get large quotes. So together, and it's one reason that the not the amount of quotes. So I'll just jump right in here. And this is exposed to our agreements have been doing. I can say that from the time frame of 2029, it's really been impacting wildfire rates. Creating separate section while I draft the range that we are building into. It's interesting here. It's actually for us to buy a little bit more of the general liability coverage, showing the increase of limit to 185 million. It's combined with our wildfire coverage, but there's some limit of 150 million for wildfire. It seems strange that it would be cheaper to buy more insurance, and it's a really technical explanation a little bit with our broker to work out. And I don't want to try and confuse everybody right now. But certainly, if there are any questions about that, or discussion. But suffice it to say, still a pretty broad range of 36% to 74% increase this year, which again is below what we think the insurance market. I think the possibility could be based on what's referencing with other clients. His other clients have not had the same experience that he had in terms of percentage of increase in the premiums. And he thinks that is because they're not as advanced in wildfire mitigation work that we know. And they also don't have a long time program in place. And so he thinks that's driving their higher premium. We have, by the way, our also through top tier broker. He has, I'll say on the property, I want to talk to him, just spoke to some of his clients. I won't speak to who his clients are, the liabilities side, but on the property side, the property program, to give you an idea of the type of grant he has. Property side, again, primarily driven by inflation. We had a last minute question come up that I wasn't able to account for in this presentation. Really, we think we're going to be there's a mix up on some of the property values that the broker received, or but we this could go up to 2.8 million, so it might be like the 10% of that. That would for that, it's not, however. Error for both sides. So this is what the overall combined with all of the different together. Player and the property line here. And this is side, it gives us up to the 7.7. This could attack for uncertainty. Our program. We saw the changes to the liability market happened around the first year, so we didn't have the opportunity to adjust our budget at that point. So we will likely be over budget between 5% and 14%. That I would like to consider. Certainly, available for any questions.
I would just say that in light of the market to be over budget by 5% to 14%, that actually is pretty minimal. True for all this group as well. Even with 31 underwriters. You can, you still have to do it.
So since I've got a couple of comments, since it directly relates to our fire preparedness, ran into John in the hallway this morning, all excited about a workshop that Commissioner Arsenal and I went to last week in San Diego at American Public Power, about fire prevention activities and presentation we had from Sacramento Municipal Utilities, SMUD. And because that in that presentation, they talked about activities they had undertaken in their transmission corridor, which is a 57-mile corridor, going from some of their hydro projects down to Sacramento. And they had engaged all of the property owners along the way, and there were, I think, hundreds of property owners, including the BLM, Forest Service, the agencies. And I really wanted to deliver this message to Ron. Once again, found out that our staff is miles ahead of us, which is where we want you to be. So I'm much appreciated. Ron's been engaged with this individual for many years, for quite some time, talking about the activity that they have done in that 57-mile transmission corridor. They went from several thousand trees that they took over transmission lines to today, they're down to zero. And they had to get agreement from all of the property owners all along the way to make this change happen. But in that process, one of the questions that was raised, which was very significantly answered in the workshop, is yes, it has really got the attention of our insurance company. And so, like I say, Ron was all over this already, but, you know, and Sacramento has actually offered to work with us on what they did there, because it was not a cheap fix. I don't know how expensive it was. I do know they said that at the end of the day, they ended up, it was either $5 or $10 million under budget. So I don't know what that means, the size of the budget was to do what they did, but it was big.
Yeah, I would just add that Eric Brown of the City of Mitchell, it's the vegetation manager for Sacramento Utility District. And he had a meeting with our wildfire planning team about a month ago, where his entire presentation showed all of the work that they did with the standing by upstanding. Very generous with the time. It's actually their third meeting for me, but the first among the larger group. And there's a lot of lessons that we took away that in terms of trying to get approvals from property owners to go and expand right away, and also approvals from the Forest Service. So our transmission folks are engaged, Eric and property. Additional information that you provide, additional meetings. So it's a very great opportunity that we're trying to
do. So anyway, I just say kudos to our staff once again, because we're looking at all the options to make this a better place to be.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
It's nice to see that the work on FSOM is having positive benefits. Commissioners, I feel like we need to really engage with the FEMA on this CAFID issue. You know, why some people have options for tools, and we need public sector help. Just my. Do I have any other questions? Questions for the public? Do I have a motion?
I move to authorize the signatures by the district not to exceed 7.8 million plus surplus lines taxes and fees for the purchase of district insurance for July 1. Policies upon conditions by the general.
Second. Further discussion? Favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much.
Looking forward to getting across the finish line, huh? Thanks, Ron. Thank you.
Six, advanced metering structure.
Yep, I'd like to invite Katie Marshall and Ken McCullough. Katie and Ken are gonna get an update on our AMI deployment and just some of the things we're already learning and being able to take advantage of the data on, as well as a concept for the opt-out program.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Katie Marshall, Texas Utilities Technology Manager. The superintendent of the parish. Give him the floor for a second, because I think it's the first time he's presented to you guys, and just let him do it.
Thank you. Yes, this is actually the first time I've been in here. Thank you for having me here. I've been with the district now 3 years as of Friday. This is the third utility I've worked for, so the third AMI deployments that I've been a part of. I don't know what that says about me.
It depends. We'll see.
Talked to AMI deployments. This was actually the smoothest AMI deployment I've been a part of. Actually, probably one of the more successful AMI deployments that I've been a part of. The last utility I worked for, they're still in the middle of it. And that's been going on for almost 7 years.
Just covering what we're going to talk about today, giving you a brief project status update. I've been here since spring and earlier this year, so you've heard some about where we're at, but just kind of some final updates on where we're at with the initial deployment. Share some success stories that we're already seeing from the technology being deployed out in the community. Talk about some upcoming efforts that we also have as kind of phase two type efforts with it. And then just open up discussion around staff recommendations to encourage more customers. As far as project status goes, we've completed the full deployment of meters. So our contracted meter exchange and installers have checked. We have a little over 50,000 advanced meters that are installed out in our territory. This spring, we held numerous AMI informational sessions, basically all over the county, and inviting customers to learn more and get any questions they have answered about that they might have outstanding about advanced meters. We also implemented our opt-out fee for those customers opting out of our what we call the more standard meter, and that began on June 1st. We picked off what we call the network optimization phase of the project. So it's kind of the last major phase of the initial AMI deployment. And it's about a 3 month effort. And I think we're about a month in. And really it just focuses on analyzing the network of equipment we have out there that backhauls all of the meter reads and that data back to our systems back here. And so just making sure we're adding resiliency and that if, you know, a piece of equipment goes down, some of it can pick it up. And so we may, over the next couple of months, need to install a couple more pieces of equipment out in the field, but for the most part, I think it's the final stretch on the initial deployment and going well. I'm going to turn it over to Ken and let him talk about some of the areas that we've seen this technology already helping us in that.
So as you can see by the slide, that some of these success stories are for external customers and some are internal customers that we use ourselves. And the very first one is talking about the South Shore substation when they were taking it offline for maintenance. One of the things that AMI allowed us to do was watch the voltage throughout the service center for that substation. And if there was a drop in voltage, we would know that we would need to take those customers offline so that we didn't lose that sub. And thankfully for us, the sub held, so we didn't need to take any of those customers offline. Also, due to voltage alarms, the low voltage helped us to identify that there were issues at the first creek area. And after sending distribution employees up there, they were able to determine that there was actually damaged secondary conductor that needed to be replaced. Once that was replaced, that took care of that issue. The Lake Wenatchee area being able to watch near real time to help them to prevent overflows for any of their step tanks out there. And then also for the internal or the external customers, being able to see outages and being able to get those outages fixed before customers get home. You know, they get home, they see the blinking lights, they know that something happened, but it's taken care of before they're even aware of it. So we're not having to wait for them to call us to know that those outages are there. And then we had one more that took place after this. After this was put together, and that was actually up in the home, we were finding that we were having high voltage issues up there with some of the meters, and that actually led us to finding that there was actually an issue with one of the regulator banks up there. Sending a few servicemen up there to look at that, they were able to get that adjusted to where it needed to be, bringing those voltages back down so that the customers didn't have any issues up there.
Questions on kind of where we're starting to see these benefits. I think, you know, with the South Shore substation piece of it, historically, where we would have had to take those customers out in planned outage kind of way, starting to be able to just monitor and only do that as needed. I think some of those things are big wins.
I think back the metrics that we've been looking at about outages at our utility and trying to reduce outages, planned outage like you're talking about, that have been part of one of the downtime for customers that we'd have to put into that battery.
Yeah.
So that's an instantaneous plus. Thank you.
As far as upcoming efforts go, I think we were able to share with you some of the examples that we're benefiting from this technology. But as we integrate AMI with other systems that we have, we're going to be seeing those benefits exponentially increase. So some of the upcoming efforts that we have around integrating AMI with other technologies is first to try and get AMI data into our customers' hands. And really having have near real time access to that data. Our intention is to do that through building or procuring a customer portal. So we're in the process of working with vendors on that, but no current timeline at this point, but a near future project for us. Also getting AMI integrated with our outage management system, where right now we are seeing some outages just from the meter, but when that's fully integrated with our outage management system, our operators and dispatch will see those immediately from their side. And so those outage response times will get faster with that. And then the last effort that we have currently slated is integrating AMI with our engineering system. And that'll help us better facilitate asset management and system planning components like identifying conductors and equipment out there that we can either need structure prepared or that even future looking outside. And just one more plug that these are benefits that really only are available for us to do that. Any questions on the work we have?
It's great to see that moving forward with technology, we're looking at a reasonable implementation plan that's having immediate benefits in various areas and looking at the future on what's still left at the horizon. So, everybody's
congratulations.
It's really great to see
them. We're excited when we get to see the success. As far as other upcoming efforts, we plan to continue to work with opt-out customers as the first opt-out fees that they mentioned are now being filled so that they understand their options. After our spring outreach that I mentioned earlier, we did have several customers that opted back in, but many of our customers that applied for opt-out for several months to a year ago, and with fees now just being implemented, we did want to provide another opportunity for them to opt in to the system and see the benefits that we're realizing from this technology. So, just wanted to bring a staff recommendation forward that is an option around what we thought maybe to attend or encourage customers to still participate in this technology and receive those benefits. Looking at encouraging customers to opt in and receive benefits of advanced metering by implementing a one-time bill credit for fees. That's from June through August 2024. I will say that we get kind of just 3 months out there as a starting point for discussion. Just thinking that seems like a reasonable time frame to start, but really want to hand it over to you guys for some thoughts and stuff.
Pardon?
Yeah, I just want to
My question is, I have two. The first one, Ken, you mentioned that you worked with a utility that took 7 years and still haven't completed the why 7 years?
There's right now because of being able to just get meters. The company that they have used has had issues in getting their meter inventory and getting it to them. So they've paused twice now. I'm not sure if they are going to continue their project with that meter manufacturer or they're going to go on to a different one.
And what kind of a policy do they have for installing those meters? Is it mandatory? Did they have them knocked out at the same time as a program that we have here?
They have a similar program to what we have here. The customers could opt out.
Was that the problem in the beginning of the community? The opt out? No. So.
No, the problem that they ran into was just the manufacturer, and they just kept saying that they were having issues in getting chips to build their meters. And so this utility would get so far and they couldn't get any more inventory, and so they'd have to pause, let their contract installers go. And then when they could finally get more meters, bring the contract installers back. And then again, they went through the same issue, can't get meters, let them go. And now they're in that position where they're at the end of that contract with that distributor and are deciding whether or not they're going to stay with that or if they're going to go to a whole completely new system.
So the success of our program was that we bought those meters we had in place. We had the inventory stocked up and ready to go.
Correct.
Okay. One other issue. In the opt-out process, you're recommending 3 months as a kind of a grace period to come back in. Why just 3 months, and what's the incentive after 3 months in order to get the opt-out customers in? Because that, you know, that should be our goal, is to get them in.
Absolutely great.
And so why 3 months? Give people another opportunity to change and a greater incentive to do it.
Yeah.
Because $75 doesn't seem to be a very large incentive, and our goal should be to get them online, these meters. So I would encourage a longer grace period in order to increase the incentive over time, because that becomes a big figure. And that should be our goals to be change.
No, I totally agree with you on that. And that's our driver, as well as belonging as many customers as we can to receive those benefits and opt in. And so, like I said, when I could approach this slide, 3 months was just kind of an initial putting a time frame out there. But I can think that we're open to whatever your guys' thoughts on the migration.
So, Kirk, as I look at this, I believe this would fall under your authority to make this happen. You're seeking some input from us. And so we'll look forward to, so this is not a motion, this is just keeping Correct. Us informed. So, do we have any other recommendations for Kirk?
Is there a time frame? I know you said longer, but are you thinking 12 months?
Well, for me, I haven't really come to a conclusion of how many months, but in a minimum of 12 months, if not even longer, because the goal is to get the meters change, not to have a punitive charge of customer who choose to opt out. And so the longer it goes, the greater the incentive becomes for someone to
come back in. If they get a rebate of that nature, they'll get it back. And there needs to be a sunset. I agree. There needs to be a time, but incentive should be large enough, Commissioner, that it really becomes something. You know, it's worthwhile. But, you know, Christmas comes around, somebody looked at a rebate, this is the way it looks. So to me, that should be our goal. Can we charge customers because they need to decision we offer them to make. So that's just my thought.
And just to clarify, this is probably not a crystal clear area. Board sets policy, general manager implements and administers that policy. And so when we get into some of these distinctions, I think I have the authority to do that, but want to just clarify that too with you all. If you feel like I have the authority, I can certainly take the feedback and work with staff and look at some longer term options for the incentive, but would be curious as to this or longer and just your comfort level with that.
So I have to agree, $75 is not a lot. And so I'm aligned looking at longer.
So if we, how long is the gold star as this time frame found one started to what they're paying right now? I don't know.
So just implemented option first. We waited the duration of the project so that it would time wise be the same for all of our customers who just when we were deploying in their area. So it just started on June 1.
Hey, I have a question, a comment, but the question. So what happens if in a few years from now, someone bought it out, has a meter failure? And because they have a meter failure, would they be given an opportunity to use an older analog meter, or would they then be upgraded to AMI? If they're upgraded to AMI and there is no extension, would they then suffer a large charge at that time? Just a question. I don't really need an answer, but I'm trying to look into the future and see how impact might be unintended.
Well, I know Ken, this is one of the things, and Ken was very humble there, but we're very fortunate to have him and his experience from having gone through this. But I'll let him share some of the things we've done in that situation to protect in that situation.
So the answer to your question, no, we do still have analog meters that we are holding on to for those customers. And they have been told that we are actually implementing testing of the analog meters that are out there, make sure that they're still within the 2% accuracy level. And if they don't pass, then we will replace those with a like meter. And if in the future we get to the point that we do not have analog meters, then we have other avenues that we can go down. It'll be decided by probably Kirk and those above me, but we can turn the radios off on an AMI meter. So you would still have a meter in your socket. It just won't have that radio turned on. So you would still be able to stay in that opt-out state.
Great. Thank you. You can see where my concern was going.
Yeah, absolutely.
It seems like we might have some of those who have opted out to opt in now that the billings are coming out. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. Looking forward to feedback.
So if you're all comfortable, I'll work with staff and we'll come back with and let you know what we decided on the time frame for the incentive.
No one, as we're starting, I appreciate Commissioner Bergeron's comments. Maybe this first year, there is a 12-month opt back in and with reimbursement, and then after that, a 1-year period, it's a 3-month set in to still continue to get somebody back in to opt out. So, those are just some of my thoughts.
Great. Thank you.
Just a curiosity question, and maybe you've talked about it. Change hands. Is there, what happens when an opt-out home sells?
We have a process internally that we know when that occurs. And so we have a standard process, stop that meter for our advanced meter at this point. And then if that customer is moving within our territory, they can apply for the new premise or where they want to be in the agency.
Great presentation, and appreciate the continued efforts to get people on the system, and we're committed to that, and we'll look forward to what you come up with.
Yeah, and I just want to commend Katie and Ken. I've heard a lot of stories from our fellow utilities that are implementing these programs, and one of them, the one that Ken talked about, is quite common, which is a supply chain issue. To have a contractor in place deploying meters and then to run out of meters and not know when you're going to get them is very common. So kudos to these two for managing that risk along the way. The second one that I rarely hear other utilities doing is using the data right away, being able to have the system set up, be able to immediately start using the data of operations and customer service. So kudos to both of you and the team for all the work on that.
I'm going out and sat in my house and looking at the meter. Did we use ITRON?
We did.
And we were both jumping the state.
Any further questions from the public? Hearing any, we'll move on to item number 70. Thank you both.
Yeah, I'd like to invite John Sagister up for Powerhouse 2 update. And this can be confusing because we have a resolution coming shortly, but this is for a resolution that would be coming at the next meeting or the one after. So thank you.
I'm the end of Rock Island Powerhouse 2 project delivery, also the program manager for the Powerhouse 2 turbine generator rehabilitation programs. This morning, we're going to give you some information on the next guaranteed maximum price amendment for the second unit, which is currently planned to be used separately. First, we have some special guests. So I'd like to introduce Cyril Pinot and Pierre Rum. These gentlemen are GE's project directors. So they've been on the project working with us since the request for proposal stage, which you may recall started in 2019. So we've had the good pleasure of working with them closely for the last 5 years. Devin and I are currently engaged with them finalizing the details associated with the guaranteed maximum price amendment that I'll be presenting today. So they just happened to be in town and thought it would be interesting to meet you all and hear about our proceedings and what we're doing. Again, this is the guaranteed maximum price amendment for the second unit, currently planned to be 7. The price will be $75.9 million, which increases an not to exceed amount for all the work that we have achieved through that unit to 200. Again, no action today. This is really just for your information. This is just a timeline and executed this design build agreement with GE in July of 2020. We do have an extended correction period, which provides 10 years warranty for all units. We executed that in 2021, along with the first unit guaranteed maximum price limit in July of 2021. Started the rehabilitation of that first unit in January of 2023. And then also in April of 2023, we authorized another guaranteed maximum price amendment for long lead items associated with second unit and other units as well. Brief description or nature of the work, it's important to remember that this is really the first time within a generation that we've done any work like this. The generators associated with these bulb units were removed from service and taken out, replaced back in the mid-80s as part of a warranty issue associated with those generators. And that's really the last time that we've done any major rehabilitation work on those units. Most of the people within the district and even within the industry that were associated with that work have retired or moved on to other things. We do have a couple of people in the district that were apprentices at the time and remember that work happening, but that's about as far as they go. They weren't involved in, and so there's limited knowledge. Similarly, the turbines were installed in the 70s and not been since, so it's been a long time. It's also important to note that at least within the industry, specifically in North America, we do have a lot of experience with new bulb units. There's some going in along the ankle repair units, put in several bulb units recently. There's some up in Canada that they're doing recently. But as far as rehabilitation work, it's pretty limited. There is a lot around the generator rehabilitation, but a lot of parents don't get a lot of attention. Work is really pursued in six unique phases. We have the design phase, manufacturing phase, disassembly, refurbishment, reassembly, and commissioning. Refurbishment is contained in the first unit, GMP, only includes time and schedule to grit blast, inspect, and repaint the complex. So if there's any repairs, use them or anything like that, that's going to be additional labor. Are those known unknowns or unknown unknowns that we talked about earlier, soft skills that we know what the conditions of some of these components are, we haven't been able to lay eyes on them since the 1970s or 1980s, right? So what that means is that any repairs that we do, that will be a change order of the contract, or again, we have a tool within the contract called allowances. If we know we're going to do some work, we don't know how much or how many, then we can use allowances for things like that. So that's another tool that we have in the contract, things like that. For the first unit, unit E5, most of the design work has been completed and will be identical for all the future units. So we don't have to repeat really the design process, the majority of the design process for future units. There are unique aspects to each unit or some. So we have left-hand units and right-hand units, so they have some unique design considerations. We have the units that are on each end of the house. They have accessibility issues, so those are things that we need to be able to meet the design features. But for both part of the design phase, we can really reduce. U5, this assembly is complete. That took approximately 7 months longer than anticipated. The main issues that we ran into were the as-found measurements, making sure we knew where that unit was in space in relation to everything embedded in concrete so we could get it back to the panel. And also tooling. And we'll talk more about those things a little bit later on. The refurbishment work is in process. We're about 50% complete today. Crossguide tubes has the potential to extend the critical path into first quarter of 2025. But so far, that's the only component that we've ran. that could, that is extended the scale of what could expand. As you might guess, this is the most dynamic phase of the process, discovering all the things that we don't know. Discovering all those unknowns, so to speak. And reassembly is expected to end in Q3 of 2024. We also expect it to be one of the most challenging phases of one. As you all, most of you have been out to see, the confluents are very large, they're measured in feet of diameter and weighing in tons. And yes, we put them together in position. In millimeters of thousands of an inch. So it's very precise. It's also a very delicate that front. So we talked a little bit about some of the lessons learned. These are things that we're taking note of, including the guaranteed maximum price amendment for the second. Tooling is one of the biggest ones. Currently, there's over 70 special tools that are required to be either certified for reuse, redesigned, manufactured, new, tested, just to disassemble. Additionally, there's another 15 tools or so that are required and you need just for the assembly. Put back together the same way you put it apart. The amount of work time associated with tooling and tooling situated, tested, was underestimated. So we don't anticipate that we continue to have issues. There are several tools that we're choosing to redesign to improve safety. There are the use of the tool to improve efficiency for time considerations. Size and complexity of the work is another one that was underestimated by everyone involved. Ongoing efforts both on site and in shops where the parts are being refurbished. Currently, GE is using 11 powerful equivalents, dated in engineering, quality control, procurement, project management, and other areas just to stay up with work, keep up with the project on schedule. On the district side, same. The amount of consultant and district hours required to manage the work at the current schedule is outstanding. The need for increased contractor engaging hours as well as consultant staff is expected to work at least through the second until we get fully through the only 6 days. If we have yet more experience with the assembly. Of this assembly, we had 70 laborers, subcontractors on site for 6 days per week. The cost of labor alone often exceeded $100,000 a day. This was underestimated as the impact of delays, late shipments, availability of materials, small parts, things like that impacted how the labor required it to stay on site. One day, it's associated with cost increase. The need for the size of the labor force needed to perform work. more needs to be done to make sure that they have what they. Protected by. Obviously, any changes will not be accommodated.
John, can you pull your microphone just a little bit closer? Thank you. Sorry. That's okay.
Finding shops capable of handling the components is necessary. Obviously, our size of the components that we use is challenging, let alone finding them that have when we need it and at a reasonable cost. Manufacturing is currently happening in the USA, Canada, Brazil, France, and India. GE is reviewing the manufacturing scheme to take advantage of the knowledge and experience of these shops. So if we can use a shop that already puts in the building, there should be cost and schedule advantage associated with that. But they're also looking at new shops to see if there's capabilities or possibilities to reduce costs as well as the silver benefit of the system. The refurbishment of components is being performed in Canada, the USA, and actually on site. There's a components that are conveyed to ship, or we chose to ship that is on site. GE has done a good job of rearranging shop space and making sure that it's made. But this is simply delayed, so have trickle down shops and create constants get their effect. The district continues to work with GE to expand the network of shops available for work. So we're continuing to look at shops both within Washington State, in Canada, and also the US that can have capacity to do that. A prime example is we just found a shop in Virginia that will be machining down the gates for us that will help at least the top middle. Yeah, so it's a time for us. So we'll continue and explore things like that. Contingency planning is something that we included early on. As you may recall, we did contingency planning and procured a new turbine shaft and other units just in case we end up with one of the eight items that for some reason we can't refurbish. The things on hold for a year to 18 months long. So we have developed some of those different contingency plans. Through this work, so far, we have identified additional areas such as the embedded flanges that could have impacted schedule by 6 to 12 months or more if we needed to do some work on them. So we have some additional that would be this year for us to. Expand those contingency plans to make sure that we're ready so we don't end up with a surprise that's going to cost us in nearly 18 months. That's in the future.
John, you might point out that embedded flange. I think you can see it.
Yes, you can.
Photo, just to give them an idea of kind of the work that's necessary to. Yeah.
So those are the embedded flanges that are obviously embedded. But the parts of the turbine, the discharge rate where the turbine sits, bolts to the downstream side here, this piece right here. And then this is the distributor ring where the wicket gates are housed. And this embedded flange right here is so that discharge bolts to that embedded flange as well. And obviously, if those are cracked, damaged, out of plumb, out of tolerance in some way, shape, or form, that could significantly impact the work because we would have to bring in a machinist to be able to well build up and machine those back to the proper surface. That's what we're talking about. Other questions? Thanks for that. So what does this mean to the second unit? Well, it means the, unfortunately, most of the lessons learned we have increase the cost associated with that. So right now we have a guaranteed maximum price amendment of just under $76 million. We do have higher allowances and contingencies, and these are the tools to help us deal with it within the contract. It is important to note that the allowances are higher because we're including refurbishment of some of the components, such as the turbine blades. We've got an idea of what kind of repairs we're going to make on turbine blades or the upstream hatch cover or some of these other parts. So we've included them with the base scope as well as allowances to cover the variability of the repair. But as you can see, or you will see soon, initial costs for this guaranteed price are similar to our changed costs for the first year. So we won't experience any ones that forget that causing that price to go down as we expect, at least on the second unit. As I mentioned, we have increased the work scope, refurbishment components similar to what we've experienced on the first unit to date. Also, things make the cost that we could replace water guides, governor tanks, floor elevation, we're just going to go ahead and fill those new manufacturing rather than waiting to get that part out and see if we can use their office and replace it, which gives us schedule advantage as well as cost advantages because we're not doing it on a basis. We do anticipate this schedule will be 17 and a half months. This is about the same duration that we anticipated the first unit to take. Again, with delays and things that we talked about, we're expecting our first unit to take just over 24 months, or 26 months. So we are seeing a fairly substantial decrease in the overall schedule, but again, not to the extent that we anticipated in phases of the program. Even as we begin work on the second unit, obviously there's a lot that we don't know. And as I've mentioned, we are in the middle of the refurbishment phase for the first unit, so there's still components that we have completely evaluated. As well as we have assembled the unit or done any finishing. Still a lot of learning to be done on this first unit that we can't incorporate as guaranteed maximum price limit for the next unit. Similarly, as you know, the generators will be designed to address the issues, the original warranty issue that we had to replace it for in the 1980s. Still need to do testing on those generators once they're built and in place, make sure that they're performing as expected, as well as the operation of the airfield hub. The airfield hub is somewhat unique because of the operating data coming into the third or fourth unit before we get a chance to get enough operating data to know really how those airfield hubs are performing. And if we're going to have to do any major work or redesigns or anything of those. So there will be a lot of work associated with that. Overall program cost to date, and these are project budgets rather than contract. Just to be as clear as we can. So for U1 through 8 common, which things common to all 8 units, 15.6 million. And then costs for the extended correction period, our current budget for the first unit, as well as you can see our forecasted budget for the second unit, U7. As I mentioned, with a lot of learning still going on. Market's been a bit unpredictable for obvious reasons over the last years. It's hopefully stabilizing. But really, what additional costs are going to be for subsequent units is pretty hard to tell, as well as where we're going to end up at the overall program. So continue to work on the forecasts and update you as we go and as we learn more. Financially, obviously the costs are higher first 2 units, coupled with market conditions create higher uncertainty for the overall program costs. As mentioned, we need to complete the second unit as a minimum before we can expect to make any forecasts based on reality and our actual costs per load. With the second unit not scheduled to be completed until 2026, it could be certain here for the full of uncertainty rated program costs before we understand the forecasts and potential impacts kind on of district finances. One thing that is certain is that it will increase the long-term cost of production air quality. While the overall impact is to be determined, various scenarios have been explored by district finance as well as risk areas. Economic analysis have been explored to reflect that a rocket of district cost of power increasing, but really below market values at this point. On a positive note, as you know, the district's strong financial metrics and liquidity position us to weather the uncertainty around costs, and the project is forecasted to return positive NPV for the district customers and members of power purchasers. And we are fortunate because the market is moving right at this point in time. The market is moving at the same time. Price volatility is common. And one of the things we can issue the GMPs for guaranteed maximum price amendments 1 year at this time. It gives us that opportunity to make a decision based on some of the volatility and certainty that we're So what are the next steps? Well, and so again, we'll be back in Q3, which really is July. I'm surprised that we're in Q3 already. July, August timeframe, we'll be back requesting authorization to execute that guaranteed maximum price amendment for the second unit. With a cost not to exceed of $75.9 million, 17 and a half month duration. Currently, it's planned to start after the first unit commissioning, which again is currently scheduled for January, but with some uncertainties, likely will be in that Q1 of 2025 timeframe before we finish the first unit and start on that second unit. It is important to note that when we come back, we will be requesting a budget revision for the capital project associated with Unit D7. And this is mainly to make sure that the project has sufficient budget for the contract value that we're adding. It does not affect our 2024 plan. We've already included that in the budget processing, our business planning process when you approved the budget last fall, but it will affect obviously the forecasts 2025, 2026, but those changes will be dealt with during the annual planning process. And that's all I have, unless there are questions.
That was quite an update, John.
Yeah, that was a mouthful.
Commissioners, questions?
Will you remind me, once the upgrade is done or the rehabs, how does that extend the supply of the future?
Currently, we have a design for 40 years. So our hope is similar to the way they initially performed. We'll do this, and then we won't be back to redo this work until, I can't even do math, 2064.
Yeah.
Yeah, before you need a batch of people.
It is is, you know, work that we've seen in a generation.
So although the timeframe for 25 seems significant, we advertise that it's not 5 months per year.
I will take your math on that.
Makes me feel bad. Let me just say that.
We haven't talked about this in a long time. When the rehab is done, will we see efficiency gains in terms of generating more electricity for every gallon of water that goes through the field?
We are expecting an efficiency increase in the generator. I would say I'd be surprised if you noticed. It's very similar, and that was actually one of our intentional design criteria, was to keep the units as similar as possible, mainly for hydraulic capacity and fish passage and things like that. We wanted to, they've been such solid performers, we've got good mortality rates through the units. We wanted to make sure that we kept it same.
Don't
mess with success.
But do I hear you say these will have the new hubs?
It will have
the air.
The internal will be different.
Okay.
Yep. So the internals to the hub will be different. They'll be filled with air and have what I'm looking for, greaseless bushings in the hub. But the hydraulic profile, the blade profile, etc., will all stay here.
You know, if we go through this whole process over a long period of time and take units out, there's with Rock Island, because we have the two generating stations, there's really not a lot of revenue. Is there? When we're taking it out, there's a lot of revenue. But because we have so much capacity that it's in there, I'm just wondering what that impact is.
Kurt could probably answer that better, but I'll make my best shot at it. Mm-hmm. It really depends on river flow, right? Sure. How much water is coming down, and so it varies from month to month and year to year, really depending on the water concentration. In general, because we're going to have one unit out for such an extended period of time, really we'll have a unit out in Power House 2 from now until 2033 or so.
Power House 1, we don't run all of our units. We have more capacity than we have water. We don't have heavy.
Real interest. To the district. At least from a financial evaluation. And also note that one house two unit probably part is worth megawatt capacity and hydraulic flow. So if we have one unit out, we have two people running in powerhouse one.
Well, just trying to point out that it's kind of a unique situation on the land that we have, and so we can ship one to two, or in some sense, take other dams to have an option, but still time is money.
Yep. We take advantage of during the spring and fall when we have low flows, and so it's out with less generation. But then again, because we're going so long during the summer, we do know those generation. We have units out for us too, and so we do. In those seasons.
Questions from the public minutes. John, thank you very much for the time and very thorough presentation and for our guests. Thank you for being here. Is there anything else and you'd like to say? We just want to welcome you and
thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Summary, John.
Yeah.
an agreement.
Did I hear that this is the largest project that GE has?
Yes, it's one of the largest.
I'm going to come up to the mic right here, or you can come sit with John, either one, whichever is comfortable.
This is Cyril Pano, project director from GE.
Yeah, Mark. So yes, it's one of the largest projects that GE Hydro has had in currently in execution. It is. I mean, we have a big involvement as well from our leadership. It's a lot of visibility within the business. As John mentioned, we've been collaborating for over 4 years. Coming to NHE on a regular basis, develop this relationship and make sure there is a very tight coordination for all aligned, trying to make sure that if to react quickly in fact when potential issues.
Sorry, you turned in. Thank you, Steve. You're very observant. I just really wanted to point out that we're doing something here that is very innovative, and that really we should gloss over. We should really celebrate, and that is that these hubs are going to be quite different from what we've had before. Would you mind to just take a second so that maybe those listening would have an opportunity to hear about the difference between our hubs that we're putting in?
Sure. So the current turbine hubs at Rock Island Powerhouse 2 use bronze bushing and oil-filled hub for lubrication to prevent corrosion within it, as well as reduce friction for when the blades need to move, things like that. Each hub holds 1,500 gallons of oil, something along those lines. And they have a seal between the blades called the trunnion seal that keeps the oil in the hub and keeps the water in the river. So if we have a problem with one of those trunnion seals, we end up leaking oil directly into the river. It's a direct path into the river. And really only detectable by machine on the tail race, which is not your best detection method. So the new hubs will remove all that oil from the turbine hub and will use really aviation technology and greaseless bushing that they use in helicopter blades for the create a frictionless surface or a low friction surface for the turbine blade trunnions to run off instead of bronze and oil for lubrication and lower friction use. We'll use that technology, fill it full of air that continuous to blows in there. So we'll blow dry, clean air in there to prevent corrosion or any erosion or buildup within the hub, as well as ensure that the hubs don't get damaged. We're also putting in a dual seal arrangement with a leak pack protection in between those seals. So if oil from the hydraulic or another part of the turbine system gets past the seals and gets into the hub and the seal leaks, it will be detected before it leaks into the river. Similarly, if we start getting river water that's leaking past a damaged seal, we'll be able to detect it and do something about it before it gets into the hub and does damage to our bushings or causes corrosion.
I wanted to have that brought forward only because I'd like to say kudos to staff for thinking outside the box, being creative, being innovative, and coming forward and suggesting and actually following through and then installing systems that prevent that oil in the water. And we are among the first, is that right, in the United States?
We are, this is, well, and kudos to GE. So, right, it's their design.
Yes.
And kudos to you guys for entrusting us because this is serial number one.
Excellent. So I just want to say for the staff, for GE, great idea, great plan,
yeah.
Wonderful implementation. Thank you.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, there's still a lot of learning and could be years before we know all there is to know about the airfield hub and what successful it is, what we need to do to make sure that it is.
Today, great presentation. All right. Thank you. So at this point, I'm going to open up the mic to any public, further public comment or anything that was up on the agenda. Seeing none, I am going to do something and take a 10-minute break. Are you okay with that? We usually don't do that, but we're starting an hour early. So, commissioners, with your permission, so in 10 minutes, 11 o'clock, we are readjourning our meeting. We are now moving into our business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everybody to please silence any electronic devices if you have them today and you haven't already done that. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion on that? All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Against? Motion passes. All right. Kurt, let's move on to item number 11.
Okay. Just maybe at any point in time, I think you can all pick all these resolutions together, but there's some that are unique. And at any point in time, if any of you feel like any of these are unique enough to take by themselves, just let us know along the way.
Before we move on, just to let you know, my plan was to go through the motions down through 15. But again, anybody that wants to discuss and move or vote on any of these singly, let me know. But that's my plan to go down. All right. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to invite John Sagasser and Devin Myers up. This is a resolution authorizing the execution of field work order change order number 8-GMP2 under contract number 18-10 with GE Renewables LLC of Greenwood Village, Colorado for the Rock Island Dam Powerhouse 2 Generating Unit Rehabilitation Project, not to be confused with the last presentation.
Thanks, Kirk. As you mentioned, this is field work number 8, the guaranteed maximum price amendment number 2 for the first unit. As we discussed previously, this is mainly dealing with the refurbishment of existing components being rehabilitated for the first unit. It's made up of 13 unique items. This is the use of allowances, which again, those are already included in the guaranteed maximum price amendment or guaranteed maximum price, as well as adds approximately $4.7 million to the guaranteed maximum price associated with that first unit. I will let Devin go ahead and fill you in on details.
Okay. Hi, my name's Devin Myers. I'm a project manager down at Powerhouse or down at Rock Island, working in the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation program. And as John mentioned, I'm here to present some details about field work order 8 for GMP2, which is associated with the first unit we're doing down there. And there are 13 items in this field work order that are associated with the refurbishment work that he was talking about earlier in the presentation. So item one is piping inside the vault. This one mainly due to inflation related to the cost of materials and labor since the original estimate in 2021. This is the largest single line item in this field work order for about $2.2 million increase to the contract price. Item two is the upstream hatch cover repairs, and this one addresses cracks and damage to welds and surfaces related to the upstream hatch cover and adds $490,000 to the contract price. And three is for runner hub refurbishment, and this addresses cavitation and original casting flaws, repairs in the high stress areas, particularly in the blade tip regions, and adds $390,000 to the contract price. And this is one that John alluded to earlier, the Wickagate servo motors. There's a component there called the guide tube, which could not be reused and is being required to remanufacture a new one. And so this is one of the items in the field work order that is competing with some other items for the critical path. And one of the reasons the contractors are forecasting a 2025 return to service date. There are nine other items addressing repairs to the turbine guide bearings, turbine runner hubs, generator rotor poles, and other components. And as mentioned, this field work order authorizes the use of allowances and adds approximately $4.7 million to the contract price for GMP2 for a revised contract price of $77.5 million and revised sum of all GMPs under contract 1810 with GE increases to $127.9 million. That's what I have. So if there are any questions, kind of went through that fast, sorry.
Was that the picture that we saw earlier in the presentation?
It was hanging off that, yeah.
Of saying, that is the hatch cover.
That's one of those where you have a picture in your mind that's different until you see that.
I was just going to mention as well that the runner blades that we're talking about here are the same runner blades that came out of U5. And this is part of, as he was talking about, maintaining the same hydraulic signature in the water passage. So they're just being kind of taken back to new put in.
I would just like to take a moment to comment and extend a sincere thank you for a tour that I received at Rock Island, maybe last year this time. And the turbine was dewatered, the bulb turbine was dewatered, and I had an opportunity to stick my head inside and take a look so that a picture, in this case, a view, is worth a thousand words to be able to see what it looked like. And so as we were talking today and using some pictures, I was right there with you. And so that's part of a commissioner's education that I received that was invaluable. So I just want to say thank you to staff for giving me that tour so that I had a vision of what it is we're replacing, repairing, upgrading hatch covers. And I still don't know how it all works, actually. I'll be the first to confess, but I have a much better idea of the components that we're discussing. So thank you.
You're welcome. Come back anytime.
Yeah. The best part isn't knowing how it works, it's knowing that it does work.
Right. As discussed, you know, we're about halfway through the refurbishment process on this first unit, so we expect to have more repairs and more costs. So we'll be back, and again, we'll be back in Q3 for requesting authorization to execute GMP4 for the second. Very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item number 12
is a resolution ratifying, resolution ratifying field work order change order number one and approving field work order change order number two for contract number 23-12956 with SC Incorporated Business as Smith Excavation of Cashmere, Washington for unit services. Welcome back, Toby.
Good morning, I'm Toby Tarswell, project manager here at the Service Center. This is a resolution to increase the not to exceed contract value. Smith recently took part in some work they did for the smoke transformer spill that was out recently. They've been working with us for about 6 months on this contract. Very positive feedback so far from all the different departments that they've worked for and have a rather large project on Leavenworth area, which is a little replacement that they're starting to work on. And it's consumed this contract. So looking to cover the rest of their work for this year, extend them next year's contract option, and then cover that meeting as well. Thank you.
Number 13.
I can invite Brett Bickford up. This is the resolution declaring an emergency pursuant to RCW 54.04.070 and 39.04.280 and authorizing the general manager to contract for goods and services related to the repair of the Rock Island spillway concrete cracks. And you recall, Brett gave you an update a couple of meetings ago that we might be doing this, and we have since declared the emergency and looking for your ratification of that today. So, Brett.
Good morning, Brett Bickford, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. The Rock Island Dam spillway has 31 spillway bays. 11 of those have auto hoists, and the other 20 bays we use gantry cranes to help move, help raise the gates, and also to move them off the deck in the event of really high flows. We've been working on expansion joint repairs for the past several years. As doing part of that work, we identified some additional cracking along what we're calling the downstream parapet wall. So if you can kind of see my mouth's a little crosshair there, the parapet wall is this structure here. There's a crane rail on top of it here. You can see up here the number two. These cranes run back and forth along this rail system. And the parapet wall is a structural beam that supports that gantry crane, and there's one on the upstream side as well. We identified some cracking by looking in the joints that we've cut as part of the expansion joint work. We did some structural evaluation, determined that we needed to do more investigations. So we did that in April with a UT device, and we found substantially more cracking within that wall. Structural evaluation has...
What's a UT device?
Ultrasonic testing. So we did some more structural evaluation that identified that the capacity of this is reduced because of that cracking, and therefore that increases the time that it would take us to move gates off the deck in the event of high flows. The emergency will allow us to proceed rapidly by bringing a construction contractor on board with an engineering firm, help us get to a more rapid solution to this and so that we can try to implement the repairs as soon as possible. We're looking at three options, and so we're having so we received proposals from two construction contractors. We're evaluating those. So we looked at their capabilities, qualifications, and their input and experience on three alternatives. One is a cast in place repair, the other is a precast concrete beams, and the third is a steel beam option. At this point, it looks like we're going to need to replace all of the 1150 feet of this parapet wall. You can see all the conduit that's hanging off the side that has power and communications that we use to operate the spillway gates, also a redundant power between Firehouse 1 and Firehouse 2. And so we'll be working over the next month to come up with the designs for that, pick a selection, and then work to figure out how to do this work in place in an operating environment, Rock Island Dam. Any other questions?
Can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. In replacing that wall, is that, so you mentioned the metal or the concrete section of that?
Yeah,
just share that to me.
It's not real clear in this picture, but underneath the rail is a concrete beam. It's about 3 feet, 10 inches above the deck, but it also goes down about 3 feet below. So it's about 7 feet high above the piers.
And that's the part.
And that's the structural beam that needs to be replaced.
And that'll be replaced with what to be yet to German metal concrete.
Right. We're looking at precast, which means we can build beams off-site and then bring them in and set them in place, which looks like might be the most expeditious option as opposed to cast in place would be cutting out sections and then building forms on place and pouring in place.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for. I'd like to invite Felicity up. This is a resolution revising the financial criteria for funding the public power benefit program. You might recall this is the last couple of meetings we've talked about the public power benefit program and the need for a resolution to continue. And Felicity is back with suggested changes. And thank you, Felicity, for all the work you've done on this.
Thank you. Felicity Saberhagen, business manager here at headquarters. This resolution is an update to the financial criteria, as Kirk mentioned, for the public power benefit fund administration. This, we're back to you today with feedback from the board that we received that you would like some changes to. We will be allowing carryover of funds, and because of allowing carryover of funds, we'd also be reporting to the board on a quarterly basis what that fund balance would be. Second of all, we would also be including a balance of that fund in review of the materials in line with the best possible way for our customers. And lastly, this resolution also establishes funding for $25 of $6 million, which is basically. And going forward, we would be setting that allocation level based on our financial criteria on an annual basis, as opposed to doing what we did in the last 52 period, which was set at $6 million. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome. Excited, this will be fun to keep the program going.
And moving on to 15.
Yep, I'd like to invite Lane Heichel up. This is a resolution approving bid advertisement award and contract execution for the Electric Avenue development at the Avenue bid number 24-13440. Welcome, Lane. Sorry.
I'm a project manager here at the Service Center. You may remember today we were here to give you an update on the street redevelopment. So we'll be back and here we are. So, today we are proposing asking for approval to bid Electric Avenue, which is the roadway, as you remember, that goes through that former property of ours. So you can see the resolution. We're asking for not only for approval to bid, but to also award for that contract and just try to get two birds with one stone there. I also want to mention that in this resolution, it does not mention Fish and Wildlife building modifications. This is just solely for Electric Avenue. We're not going to bring forward Fish and Wildlife building modifications because it doesn't reach the level of dollar amount is required, but that is part of the project as part of the whole redevelopment. So it's not included in this ask, but is required for Electric Avenue to make that connection to the south side of the property. So just wanted to point that out. It's going to be a different bid solicitation and contract because of the difference in scope of work from building a road and modifying the steel structure. So that's about it. Let's see here. So Resolution 17-14215 is what we're asking.
I guess. Good question.
Thank you for the clarification on the building issues.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, one project can't be done without the other. So, but it doesn't rise to the level of approval by the board, but it will be done right after this. All right, thank you. Actually, the construction will take place right around the same time. All right, thank you.
Commissioners, resolutions 11 through 5, items 11 through 15. I'm with. Motion.
I would move approval of resolution 11 through 15.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor of items 11 through 15 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Those resolutions are. Now we'll move on to item 16 and we'll talk about the music theater.
Okay, I'd like to invite David Lodge up for the proposed motion.
Good morning, Commissioners. David Lodge, Project Management Manager. Returning after my presentation from the last board meeting, or presented a purchase and sale agreement with Music Theater. I promised to come back seeking approval. And to clarify what we're looking for today, I spoke of a resolution to approve the purchase and sale agreement. That'll actually occur after the formal surplus property, which will happen in conjunction with the binding site plan anticipated early next spring. So at this time, we're just looking for board support for entering into the purchase sale agreement by way of a motion. We've got the proposed motion up on the board.
I move to direct staff to enter into a purchase and sale agreement with Music Theater of Wenatchee for the sale of a portion of the Fifth Street property referred to as the Fish and Wildlife Building and associated parking lot subject to board approval.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes, David.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Lane, for all the work on this. I don't know if you've been down there lately, but boy, the YMCA is going to work. Pretty impressive.
He can wield a wrecking ball.
Yeah. Great. I'd like to invite Heather Ireland up for an update on.
The 18 minutes this morning to provide an update regarding our communications with Moody's Investor Services. Moody's is one of the three bond rating agencies that the district works with to evaluate our credit quality and provide that information to our investing board. Mark Mullins, the acting CFO, CRO, and I were able to meet Moody's as part of their regular review schedule last 3 weeks ago now. In late May, and we were able to give them updates on our operational condition, our financial condition, and improvements that have been going on here at the district over about the last year or so. We talked to most of our rating agencies on a pretty frequent basis, communications go back and forth, but about once every 2 to 3 years, depending on the agency, we actually do a more formal presentation process. This was part of their regular schedule. Moody's was interested in a lot of our programs going on here. They provided a lot of great feedback, asked a lot of good questions. And the outcome of that review was that they affirmed our AA2 credit rating with a stable outlook. That was something that we had strived for over many, many, many years, and we were upgraded in 2022. And then this process resulted in affirmation of that rating. We also went through a rating process with Fitch Ratings a few months ago, and they also affirmed our AA+ credit rating. So we didn't share at that time. We anticipate meeting with S&P next year as part of their rating cycle, so that would be in 2025. I did want to share just a couple of the strengths that Moody's pointed out about the district through their review process. They indicated that they view our demonstrated conservative risk management programs and processes very favorably. They also pointed out our financial strength, specifically in significant debt leveraging has occurred over the years, the district's low electric rates, and also our very, very robust power sales hedging program, which includes a mix of mid and long term contracts, which offers a demonstrated proven value of hydropower. They were very complimentary in the work the district has done over the years to be proactive in their planning. And that has certainly been demonstrated through that double H and credit rating for weeks.
You should have a bigger smile on.
It's a great to tell. It's really an interesting part of my job to learn about all the different things that we're doing here at the district. And I have the pleasure of communicating some amazing things to the rating agencies, because everything is well planned and so well thought through and so proactive in our thinking and our policies. And it truly is a honor to be able to communicate that to them. And they are always just very, very impressed with the level of work that is done here. And that shows in our credit ratings. And that is something that it's everybody from the board to our friends working together in that same direction. And that truly bears out in our results.
I just want to mind out that when we first started a hedging program back in those days, they were very cautious about that. They didn't jump on to them. This is a great, great program. When they kind of walked into it, and they were concerned about the counterparties and those kinds of things. And it's just really fun to come back here and see the progress that it's made, and you know, it's proven, you guys have proven. And that's what gives us the higher rating. It is a really solid program, so thank you.
Heather, I just have
to
hopefully you get a chuckle out of this. Last week we had a conference, American Public Power Conference, and at that conference, there was a breakout session called Rating Agency Outlook for Public Power. Prior to that session, they also had a booth set up, and I walked up to their booth wearing a very similar article of clothing, and before I could even stretch my hand out to shake their hand, they go, "Oh, we know you." And they had the managing director from S&P Global Ratings, the vice president, senior analyst from Moody's, and the managing director in public finance sector from Fitch were all at this booth. And they were all aware of who Schlen PUD was. So you have done an excellent job, as have all of the staff, to get the word out. And anyway, thank you for such a warm welcome down at the conference.
Gary and Carmen, thank you for your comments. And thank you for the presentation.
Okay, I got one more item. I'd like to invite Rachel Hansen up to give an update of some drop-in sessions on fire safety outage management. Thank you, Rachel.
Morning, Commissioners. Rachel Hansen with Communications. Schlen PUD will host a series of conversations this week with fire-prone communities about fire safety outage management and our wildfire mitigation plan. These meetings are going to be drop-in style, where community members can stop by and talk to. We'll have expert staff on hand to answer any questions or address any concerns that they have on a one-on-one basis. So the first of those meetings will be in the Leavenworth PUD Auditorium Tuesday, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. We'll have Chumstick Wildfire Stewardship Coalition and Cascadia Conservation District joining us to give information. And Wednesday will be at Beehive Grange up at Squiltruck Road, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. And on Thursday, the INEAT Chamber will host us at their meeting. It starts at 6 p.m. at INEAT Fire Hall. They're going to have a short business portion and then disperse, and we'll have an open house style meeting there as well. So you're welcome to join us. We'll have Spanish language translation on site. And we've let our customers know this is happening in a variety of ways. We sent a mailer on Friday to everyone in high fire risk areas. That's about 10,000 people. We emailed about 6,000 people also on Friday that received a 60% open rate, which is pretty successful. We've also promoted it on social media, and these meetings have been featured in every local media outlet. So hopefully we'll get a good turnout. And for those who can't make it, they're welcome to get a lot of information that we've published at chelanpud.org/FSOM and in Spanish at FSOM Español.
School check and Annie at the meeting.
Fortunately, I'll be tied up in a surgical procedure and will be out of commission for a few days, so I will not be able to attend.
I also noticed that on kind of get into this commissioner, we have it's C on Tuesday, I think. Yep. So maybe who's it coming? It's C.
It's up Gary.
Yeah, so maybe I'll go to the 11 over meeting tomorrow. And bypass Mitzi, and that way we've got commissioner of all three. Did I miss anything? Great. Rachel, thank you.
Yeah, I want to thank Rachel. Rachel has done an incredible job on our FSOM program together, and this is not an easy topic. A tough thing to convey, but Rachel's done an incredible job of helping our customers understand the need for this and also helping our utility to mitigate the risk. So thank you, Rachel.
Hey,
that's it.
Commissioner Trowell, do we have anything that
No travel this meeting.
Commissioner items.
I got a couple. Okay. So, as you've heard us mention, we went to San Diego to American Public Power last week. Time is incredibly well spent. And besides the Firewise presentation that I talked about a little bit earlier with Ron Tibbs here, we had some other really great keynote presentations. I don't know. He is on the listening. He is listening. I see his picture there.
Yep, I'm listening.
We had an incredible presentation in my eyes on artificial intelligence and why we should not be afraid of it and why we should embrace it to do what it can do for us throughout our organizations. And so I just want you to know I came back inspired to share that with you. I think the lady's name was Noelle Robbins, I think. And, you know, she is one of the people who was on the team, or maybe she led the team that developed that now infamous woman of the internet, Alexa, of Amazon, you know. And she proudly strutted out saying that she had never graduated from high school nor college. And the world has seen her skills. And she's an amazing promoter. So I'm ready now to embrace AI. I just want you to know that. And the other. Okay. The other thing I just bring back is we think our rates are low. Well, San Diego's rates, you actually have to add more than a decimal point because their off-peak electric rates at San Diego are 32 cents a kilowatt hour, and their peak rates are 73 cents a kilowatt hour at the top rate. And so and that was an aha moment. But maybe the most important day of the week last week for me was last Saturday. former Commissioner Barbara Tilley's memorial service was held on Saturday, and it was a packed house at Grace Lutheran Church up on Washington Street. I was able to sit next to our manager and a former employee by the name of Jeff Smith, who grew up specially for the service. And you know, the family did lots of marvelous things, and Barbara had organized her own service, and she was a music teacher. And so there was lots of singing of the old-time gospel that I grew up with, which gave me great comfort. And the guy sitting on my left really had a pretty good voice, and at the end of the service, he said, you know, you have a good voice too. And I said, well, thank you. And I hadn't paid close attention to it, but until somebody coming at the end of the service coming by, I said, well, it's great to see you, Governor. And I look over, and it was Gary Locke. But Gary Locke came over to Barbara Tilley's funeral. And I know that Kirk was there, and it was sort of a who's who in Wenatchee and beyond. You know, people in this area can impact lives far beyond what they think. And so it was a special service. Kirk, you know, I know it's commissioner time, but if I've missed anything, please add.
Oh, I thought you articulated that very well, and it was certainly a demonstration of a life well lived by the people there to recognize her and honor her. So, yeah, it was very special to be part of it.
Yeah, and I did miss the opening line by her youngest daughter, who was the self-declared black sheep of the family. She said she's the black sheep because she's a Democrat, and it brought the house down. So that's my commissioner.
Moving on, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
So just a couple of updates. So we had one from June 3rd, and that was Dave Nelson would provide information on a historical look at the PPP funding criteria to demonstrate the 10% allocation that the question was raised about. He did provide that by email on June 11th. And then for an action item prior to that, we had one. There was a question raised under the load forecast presentation that we do quarterly asking Lyle to include the number of meter installs going back 20 years, which you saw in today's presentation. We'll keep that updated going forward so you can get the historical look. That's it. Nothing new today.
Okay. So, do you think we need to get, I'm just wondering if we need to get Commissioner Smith and Governor Locke in a hearing with the.
Maybe so. I don't see Dave Mark will give him the last. He said I had perfect hearing. I just wanted to know.
That just went right.
Sorry. It was intended to be a compliment, I think.
I was just maybe it's your stomach grumbling. That's the problem. Still with me.
And nothing in the delegation.
Correct.
Do we have any additional public comments from the public? Hearing none, do we have any other matters of general business that may necessarily come before the commission today? Hearing none, we will recess at this time and we'll be moving into executive session to discuss legal counsel, agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigations to which the district or boards like a party and or legal risk as authorized by statute or 90 minutes, correct?
Correct.
And then we will come out of executive session after 90 minutes for board workshop. All right, we are in recess.